When I was very young and living in my Congregational Minister Father's manse, I became aware in rapid succession of eternity and infinity and personal mortality. So at the age of 5, which is heavens above, 75 years ago, although I wouldn't hear the term for another decade, I became an atheist, and I've been locked in that disbelief system ever since. Nonetheless, I am well aware of the immense significance of religion to many people, which is why it's been a constant topic of mine in columns, broadcasts, and a couple of books. And it's why I'm delighted to welcome someone to the program with whom I utterly disagree, but I'm sure we'll find points at least of mutual sympathy. My guest is, like me, fascinated by religion. Reza Aslan has numerous degrees in theology and the sociology of religion. He's also a professor of creative writing at the University of California. He's written several books about religion, including one about the life and times of Jesus. His latest is called God, A Human History of Religion, published by Penguin Random House. Reza joins us on the blower from California, but he's heading to Sydney next week to give a talk titled World Without Religion, and I will give you the details at the end of our chat. Welcome to the program, Reza, and an atheist blessings upon you.
It is a delight to be speaking with you. And let's just start right off the top and say, atheism is not disbelief. That I think, is a central fallacy, this idea that what atheism represents is lack of belief. On the contrary, atheism is just its own unique belief system. It involves a set of presumptions, postulates about the nature of reality. Many of those assumptions are unprovable. They're theoretical, though they are based on fairly reasonable analysis of the workings of the universe. I want to just jump right into it and say, you may be an atheist, but an atheist is not somebody who disbelieves. It's somebody who believes a different set of ideas than, say, a theist does.
You know, almost anything with an ism or an ology on the end is a belief system, of course.
But yes, well,
I'm here to interrogate you about God. So I shall sublimate my own beliefs. For me, religion, medicine, art, the building of pyramids, cathedrals, just about every human activity is driven by a dread of non-existence. Is that what drew you to faith in the beginning?
No. You're absolutely right that in the end, when you start to take the religious impulse, not religion. Religion is just the institutional expression of a primal impulse that goes back to the very beginning of our species. Indeed, the evidence actually indicates that religious impulse, the impulse towards belief in a transcendent reality, that's the best way that I can put it, that impulse actually predates our species. But religion is a very fairly new phenomenon. Religion is just this sort of institutionalized attempt to catalog and control that impulse. And you're absolutely right that the impulse itself is deeply embedded in the fear of a lack of existence. I think that's how you put it. And that's a nice way of putting it. And I think we have some pretty good material evidence to prove that.
You make an interesting point in the book that even before we can demonstrate that burial had a religious significance, it may have simply been to keep the body away from prying teeth.
Yes, but I think the importance is understanding the way in which a body was buried. I mean, we can come up with, I think, some, you know, reasons for burial, though I would say that when it comes to the preservation of energy and resources, which is, after all, at the heart of the survival of the fittest, simply just disposing of a body, letting the beasts come and take it away, makes much more sense than expending that kind of energy, those kinds of resources, and burying it. But more importantly, the burials come with clear, unmistakable expressions of ritual and ceremony. And I think that's where the kind of religious impulse comes. But just to answer your question, though, where you began, which was, is my own experience predicated on fear of a lack of being or a lack of existence? And the answer to that is no. I mean, I think for me, as a person of faith, I consider faith as a mode of knowing. I see it very much as part and parcel of the cognitive processes that make me who I am, that recognizing that the world is more than just the material realm that I can experience with my, you know, empirical senses, that there is another realm of knowing, another realm of being that I can access, that has far less to do with a fear of death or a fear of non-being than it does with a desire to live what I think life in its fullest expression should be.
I think we should explain to the listener that you were born to an atheist father and, as I recall, a fairly irreligious mother, and that your spiritual journey took you through pantheism to become a Sufi.
Yes, I was born in Iran, and, you know, in Iran, everybody's a Muslim. You know, it's part of your culture, it's part of your identity. I mean, yes, you know, we would go to mosque on special occasions, and we would go through, you know, some of the rituals and ceremonies that made us participate in the larger sort of, you know, Islamic communal experience. But my father was a very loud atheist and communist. And when we came to the United States after the Iranian Revolution, I think my father saw that as an opportunity to just put it all behind us. You know, in Iran, you have to pretend.
I like sometimes. Your father, I've got to say. Yeah. I warned him.
Yeah. Yeah, so he you know, my father actually, it was my father's atheism that really ended up saving all of our lives, because, you know, when Khomeini returned to Iran, what he said was that he had no interest in politics. All he wanted to do was to be left alone, to go back to his studies and back to his home. And my father, who never trusted anything anyone wearing a turban ever said on any topic, said, well, that's just BS. Let's get out just in case, you know, he's lying. And it turned out he was lying, and my father was right. I think for me that my childhood experiences of revolutionary Iran instilled in me a real appreciation for the power that religion has to transform a society for good and for bad. But I never had an opportunity to express that in any meaningful way because of, you know, the sort of lack of religion in my household until high school, when I heard the gospel story for the first time. And at that point, I converted to a very conservative brand of evangelical Christianity. And then when I went to college to study religion, the first thing that I learned is everything that I learned about Jesus was wrong. And that ultimately led to the book Zealot, which you mentioned in the opening. But it also led me to look for an alternative way of expressing my spiritual desire. And that's when I discovered Sufi Islam. And that's what I would call myself now.
And of course, there is an underlying pantheism here. And that's something which is almost universal, isn't it? It's hard to think of a faith which doesn't have some sort of pantheistic origin.
And thank you for saying that, because oftentimes when I talk about pantheism, for those unfamiliar with it, is just the belief that all is God and God is all, that essentially there can be no division between creator and creation, that they are one and the same. And I think sometimes when I talk about it, people think that I'm talking about some newfangled New Age spirituality, when in reality, not only is it a universal belief system that exists in all religious traditions, but as I outline in the book, in many ways, the most primal form of religious expression, the one that we can access in our Paleolithic ancestors, that the original belief system was pantheism, that our most ancient ancestors, when they expressed something that we would nowadays refer to as spirituality or the religious impulse, the defining way in which it was expressed is precisely this concept of pantheism. So it is a universal belief system. It's also the earliest belief system, I would say.
There's a word that I've appropriated from theology that I deploy all too often, and I'm sure you and I share it. It's a sense of the numinous. And for me, my sense of the numinous doesn't require a God, a creator, but anyone who's not in, doesn't look up into the heavens without a feeling of dread or awe or absolute mind-boggling wonderment isn't fully alive. It's a very good word, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it's important to recognize that God is just a word. It is a word that we use to express a sentiment, and the sentiment, it's what's important. Yes, it is true that, of course, as a result of thousands of years of religious institutionalization, the word God has taken on a personality, so that when we use the word God nowadays, the vast majority of people, whether they are believers or not, instantly imagine some kind of divine figure with a personality, a being with will and intention. But when we really break it down, what we mean when we say the word God is precisely the numinous, that there is something other. In fact, this is why I think sometimes I have trouble with the word atheist, particularly in the United States. I mean, there have been so many surveys done here of American religiosity that have really overturned a lot of our basic assumptions. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life showed that nearly 11% of atheists believe in a higher power. 10% of atheists believe in the existence of hell. Well, you're not an atheist. I'm sorry. If you believe in a higher power but refuse to call that thing God because you don't like the word, and if you believe that there is a place of eternal punishment for people who do bad, then you're not really an atheist, are you?
If you live in Australia, and of course you were about to visit us, you'll find that 30% of us tick the atheist box when filling out a census form. But you don't have any sort of image of God, do you? Because that would be irrelevant. It would be wrong.
In fact, it's something that I've tried very, very hard to rid myself of as I've become more spiritually mature, is to make a conscious decision to not think of God as a personality, as somebody with will and intention and desire, and indeed to think of God as an idea, to think of God as a sort of a creative impulse. But an impulse that is maybe not knowable is the wrong word, but experienceable, that I can actually experience that thing. And that's where the numinous comes. And whether you experience the numinous climbing a mountain or looking at the stars or sitting in a synagogue or praying in a mosque, it's that feeling that is a very real sensation, a very real experience that cannot just simply be dismissed, in my view, as just the sort of wanderings of an irrational mind.
I'm holding Reza Aslan's book in my hand, rather gingerly, of course, God, A Human History of Religion. We've been trying to depict that God for, well, at least 20,000 years, I guess, and you point out that there are drawings from that time which hint at a character that you called the sorcerer. Tell us about the sorcerer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the sorcerer is one of the most argued images in the study of religions. It comes from one of the many, many painted caves that dot the landscape of Europe and Asia, caves most of which were painted by Homo sapiens, but we now, of course, have discovered similar caves that were painted by Neanderthals long before Homo sapiens even arrived in Europe and Asia. And of course, there are painted caves in Australia. There are painted caves in Indonesia. There are painted caves in America. They exist everywhere. It really indicates some kind of quintessential human impulse. But in this particular cave, in the Volp caves in the Southern Pyrenees Mountains, a famed archaeologist and priest by the name of Henri Bruel discovered an image, probably about 20,000 years old, so you're right there, that he dubbed the sorcerer. It is a kind of therianthrope, which is a half animal, half human, but this is unlike any half animal or half human image we've ever seen. It's actually an amalgamation of different creatures and beasts, some of which are purely imaginated. And then more importantly, there is at the core of it an anthropomorphic figure. And the consensus nowadays among many scholars is that this is the oldest image of God that we have. We may find an older one, but from the very beginning, when the human mind was trying to make sense of what is, as we have already discussed, fundamentally just an idea, the mind did so by anthropomorphizing that idea, by humanizing it. And of course, that impulse, as I argue in the book, is what everyone does, what all religions do, that it's not so much that God fashioned us in God's image, it's that we have fashioned God in our image. We have propelled upon God, not just our own physical form, but our personality, our attributes, our desires, our weaknesses and strengths, our virtues and vices. We have constructed God to look and feel and think exactly like us. And Reza, we wonder why we have these problems.
Reza, we currently have a Pentecostal prime minister. But of course, our society is pretty agnostic compared to yours, mm-hmm. to the United States, where religiosity is absolutely out of control. How much does it distress you that so much religious expression in America is so utterly and profoundly conservative and right-wing?
Well, I would say that religion almost by definition tends towards conservatism, because if religion is all about categorizing, cataloging, and controlling the universal impulse towards spiritual belief, control, categorization, institutionalization, these are almost by definition conservative things. They lend themselves towards conservative thinking and being. I think what's unique about America is not so much its conservatism, is it the fact that here we feel that religion and the language of religion holds the most currency with the masses, right? I mean, we're in a society in which not only do we want religion to play a role in public life, in politics, you know, but we actually encourage it. The government moves out of the way so that religion can take up the space that government doesn't want to deal with in the United States. We actually give any religion, and I mean any religion, you just have to prove that it's a religion, we give it tax breaks. So religions don't have to pay any taxes. Instead, that burden is sort of taken up by the rest of us. Now, obviously, there are some serious problems with this, but I do think it's important to recognize that if you live in a democracy, then the whole point of a democracy is that you vote for people who share your values. And whatever you want to say about religion, it is a shorthand for values. Now, it can be manipulated in some disgusting ways so that when you have someone like Donald Trump, the most irreligious president that, you know, we have ever had, a man who, if you were to take all of everything Jesus preached against and then transform that into a human being, you would have Donald Trump. And yet, this is a man who has enormous support from religious groups in the United States.
Reza, I've got to tell you this. I think he's the Antichrist, and his arrival augurs the end times. But that's
I
couldn't possibly say it on air.
Well, look, he is you know, and I'm saying this as an American citizen to a foreign journalist. The president of the United States is human garbage. I mean, he is probably the worst person in America. And what's frustrating, of course, is that the worst person in America is seen as a kind of godly icon by, at this point, nearly 70-something percent of white evangelical Christians, who, I should just mention, the support for Trump has far more to do with the white part than it does with the evangelical Christian part. But nevertheless, it gives you an idea of what America is like. What the role that religion plays in America is enormous. But I do think that in many ways, it's kind of baked into the DNA of this country. And so it's unavoidable, as it were. You said the 30% of Australians tick the box that say atheist. 2.5% of Americans tick the atheist box.
I first became aware of your efforts for sanity, religious sanity at least, after 9/11, when you had to try your best to argue a case for Muslims. Did that put you in the line of fire?
Oh, most definitely. You know, the United States, in this country, 73% of the population tick the box Christian. Now, let's just be clear here for a moment. 73% of Americans are not actually Christians. 73% of Americans don't go to church on a regular basis. They don't read the Bible regularly. They don't know anything about Jesus except that he was born in a manger and died on a cross because one is Christmas and the other is Easter. But it does show something that is quintessential to understanding what religion is and how it functions. Because religion, and it doesn't matter which religion you're talking about or where in the world you're talking about, religion is far more a matter of identity than it is a matter of beliefs and practices. Of course, beliefs and practices are important. But when someone says, I'm Christian, I am Muslim, I am Jewish, I am Buddhist, they're making an identity statement, not a faith statement. And you know this as well as anyone does. The easiest way to identify yourself, be it according to religion or nationality or ethnicity or race, the easiest way to identify yourself is in opposition to an other. And in America, we've always needed an other. That other changes. It used to be Catholics. That, you know, the way that you identified what it meant to be an American was to not be Catholic. Then it became Jews. And now it's Muslims. And so in some ways, this has less to do with Islam than it does with the American character and how we define ourselves. But of course, we are in a time in which the, you know, clash of civilizations, if you will, has kind of infiltrated the thinking of a lot of people. And so, yes, I spent a good part of the early part of my career simply trying my hardest to shatter that idea and to show that there's far more in common between Muslims and Christians, between the Middle East and the United States, than I think either of those two groups would like to admit.
I'm not sure whether that's a happy note for me on which to end, but Reza, thanks very much for joining me. Reza will travel to Sydney next week as a guest of the University of New South Wales Centre for Ideas, and he'll present a talk, Reza Aslan, World Without Religion, on the evening of Friday, November the 8th, as part of Unthinkable, a three-day talks and ideas event, presented in partnership with CarriageWorks, and we, despite my atheism, will put up a link to that on the website. Good on you, Reza.